From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this remarkable program we call Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us, followed by, of course, your calls that we call Conversations with Linda. But here is what's happening. In Camden County, Missouri, police are investigating more about a report of a group of men asking about the Bagnell Dam. The Miller County Sheriff, Bill Abbott, says that the Camden County Sheriff's Office forwarded a security tip regarding the hydroelectric facility to the FBI. Police say that the incident happened about 2 weeks ago at a restaurant in Osage Beach. A deputy was eating lunch there, and the waitress staff told him about a group of men. Staffers said the men were asking strange questions about the dam, and they wanted to know if they could rent a boat and tour the dam. Could be innocent. Who knows? The Obama administration cannot be sure of the whereabouts of thousands of foreigners in the United States who had their visas revoked over terror concerns and other reasons. They have no idea where they are. The admission made at a House oversight hearing examining immigrant vetting in the wake of major terror attacks drew sharp responses from the committee people. Two people were killed in separate shootings on a western Oklahoma interstate. I mean, this is supposed to be the Christmas season. People are supposed to be nice and happy. A man drove through three counties firing randomly from his pickup truck, targeting at least four vehicles. Two people killed. The suspected shooter later surrendered, and then he was being held in a county jail. Our psychiatrist, Dr. Peter Breggin. Peter, what's happening to people? They're just all flipped out or something.
Well, you know, during this season to be jolly, people drink more. They probably take more drugs. They get more upset more easily, and there are more of them on the road. I think this is, you know, what I'd like to do is say to people who are feeling angry on the road to think about the fact that a stranger, somebody you've never seen before, can make you nearly throw your life away because they're tailgating you or they've cut you off,
yep,
or they've done something rude. And people just need to slow down and think, if I'm reacting this way, I got to say to myself, what do I need to do about my life? Because there's something frustrating you. There's something making you unhappy. Maybe you're drinking too much. Maybe your antidepressant is freaking you out. But road rage against strangers is really a sign that things are just coming loose for you.
For the person. That's right. I've always said that road rage is caused when the bad or the inconsiderate driver does something to a person who's having a really bad time.
Well, I think that's exactly it. And for those of you out there, and we've all been in this position at one time or another, most of us, who's just feeling like you're gonna lose it at somebody, don't ruin your life, somebody else's life, your family's life, over annoying anger and frustration and feeling of humiliation inside yourself. Take a look at yourself. You know, don't ruin yourself and other people that you don't even, well, for people you don't even know.
Peter, have a great holiday, my friend.
You too. You
all right, Dr. Peter Breggin. Martin Shkreli, the former hedge manager, vilified in nearly every corner of America for buying a pharmaceutical company and then jacking up the price of a life-saving drug more than 50-fold, has been arrested on securities fraud charges unrelated to that situation. The 32-year-old entrepreneur, self-promoting figure who has called himself the world's most eligible bachelor on Twitter and recently plunged into the hip-hop world by buying an unreleased album by the group Wu-Tang Clan, was in custody awaiting an appearance in federal court in Brooklyn, charged in a 7-count indictment unconnected to the drug prices imposed by his company, Turing Pharmaceuticals. The charges instead involve his actions at another drug company, Retrofin, which he ran as CEO from 2012 to 2014. Hey, the United States and Cuba have agreed to restore scheduled commercial airline service between the two countries for the first time in more than 50 years, exactly a year after they started the process of normalizing relations there. A new global temperature forecast from the United Kingdom says that next year, 2016, is likely to be even warmer than 2015. This year has already been declared the warmest on record thanks to a combination of global warming and a very strong El Niño. Cancer is overwhelmingly a result, they say now, of environmental factors, as we've always talked about, and not largely done to because of bad luck. Earlier this year, researchers sparked a debate after suggesting two-thirds of cancer types were simply down to luck rather than factors such as smoking. They're changing that. Secret Santas gave an early Christmas gift to shoppers at Walmart stores in three states. Listen to this. Anonymously paying off $484,000 they owed on holiday purchases set aside with the retailer. Walmart said the customers at several stores in Ohio, Florida, and Pennsylvania had their balances on holiday layaway accounts simply paid off by anonymous donors. I'm going to say this right now about producer Tom Danheiser, because he won't. He will go into a store every once in a while and look at somebody in line with a basket of food or wherever he may be, and he makes the assessment that this person may need a little help. He secretly goes up to the cashier and says, "I want all this paid by this person." And then he leaves. Doesn't get the recognition, doesn't get the thanks. He just takes off and leaves. And that person is dumbfounded. Who bought this? But that's what he does. How about that? UFOs still flying all over the planet. Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Peter, where are you right now?
I am up in Eastern Washington, the headquarters for the National UFO Reporting Center. But you're right to ask, George. Next week, a week from tonight, Christmas Eve, I'm going to be in none other than North Pole, Alaska. And you, of all people, know my propensity for documenting things. This is going to be my 67th Christmas on this planet, and I'm going to try to get to the bottom of this Santa Claus thing, if I can do it. I'm going to be reporting from Santa's workshop, and young kids may be pretty interested to be tuned in next week, because if I see anything unusual, by golly, I'm going to report it, George.
All right.
So,
I love it.
Just five reports tonight, some interesting stuff. We just updated our website probably an hour ago only. Last Saturday, 9 a.m., Palm Desert, California, a gentleman was driving, says he was going west on Fred Waring Boulevard or Lane in Palm Desert. I don't know where that is, but he says he looked out the side window of his car and his attention was immediately drawn to two oval or disc-shaped objects darker than the clear blue sky of Palm Desert, and he sat there enthralled behind his steering wheel. He actually pulled off the road to look at these objects. They streaked ahead of his car in unwavering formation and just disappeared to the west. He saw them for about 3 minutes, he estimates. He said they weren't birds, they weren't balloons, they weren't helicopters, they weren't aircraft, so therefore, what were they? Next day, Sunday, the 13th of December, and I know I'm going to butcher this name, but I'm going to give it a try, George.
All right.
It's a Canadian name in the Eastern Maritime Provinces, Musquodoboit Harbor in Nova Scotia. I think I did it. A gentleman who used to serve in the Canadian Air Force, so he's probably very reliable and a very qualified observer, sitting in his hot tub, he suddenly became aware of a yellow or white light. He thinks it was streaking towards him. It suddenly executed a very sharp turn and just winked out. He likens its disappearance from his sight like a shutter in a camera, just closed on itself. Very interesting report. Both of those two reports are posted to our website. The next night, Monday, actually, Monday morning, the 14th of December, a young woman was driving near Preston, Maryland. She says it's near Chop Tank, Maryland. I've never heard of that place before, but she looked up and her attention was immediately drawn to a bunch of flashing lights on the periphery of an object that was shaped somewhat like a horseshoe crab, she said. Saw it for only 15 seconds. It suddenly just disappeared from her sight. I'd like to know what happened there. I may call her back and dig a little deeper into that report. Last two reports briefly. Last night, Kenmore, New York, near Buffalo, New York, guy was taking his trash out. He saw a bunch of flashing yellow lights. He said he's never seen anything like it. Went right over his head, couldn't see a ship or a craft or any part of it except the flashing lights, but they were distinctly yellow. Shouldn't have yellow lights on any kind of aircraft that's flying legally at night. And the last case, probably the most interesting one, happened tonight, Madison, Mississippi, not Wisconsin, Mississippi, just north of Jackson in the central part of that state, I believe. A chief flight instructor, or chief mechanic, I think, rather, walked into an aviation company at Madison Airport, and he said, everybody come out here. Everybody charged out the door, and they were treated to a cluster of these peculiar red lights just moving unwaveringly across the night sky. Everybody thought it was one of the strangest things they've ever seen. And that report is posted to our homepage. People can read it. And we'll check in next week, George.
Christmas Eve, Peter. Ho, ho, ho. See you then. Dr. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. He's a great guy. Great guy indeed. In a moment, we're going to talk about Andy and Don. Now, you're probably saying, who? Well, stick around and find out. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. No, that's not me whistling, but what that is the theme from the 1960 to 68 program, The Andy Griffith Show. I remember that. I was 10 years old when it started. And gosh, I had a great time watching it. It was hilarious. And those of you who were born then or watched television in that era, you remember the program. And for this hour, we're going to do something a little different for you. We're going to talk about the relationship between Andy and Don Knox. It was truly a friendship. And the book, of course, is called Andy and Don, The Making of a Friendship in a Classic American TV Show. Daniel Duvisay is with us, and he is related. He's the late brother-in-law to the late Don Knotts. And Daniel, what a great job this is, and what a great show that was. So welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Merry Christmas, and my gosh, this is something. But you got to tell me, what made you write the book about the relationship between Andy and Don?
Well, yeah, it's been 55 years since the show went on the air.
Oh, my time. Gosh.
I used to watch it as a kid in Chicago on WGN, I think it was, probably, you know, waiting for Cub games to begin or to end. And so I grew up with it, although I'm not Southern, I'm not from a small town, but I identified with it. But that's not the reason I wrote the book, really. I wound up just by fate, you know, a member of the extended family of one of the performers on this show. Gosh, back in the 80s, Sophie was my girlfriend. She's now my wife. Her older sister started dating Don. They became a couple. And she was with him for the last 20 years of his life. They'd still be together now if he were still alive. So I was sometimes a part of his entourage. We would go to Las Vegas together, which was amazing because everybody knew who he was, and people would just gather around, and he'd be mobbed, you know, benevolently mobbed, sort of like Elvis Presley type character. We went to Disney World together. In fact, that was where I met him. Trip up to Orlando. We were living in Boca, and gosh, I'd never been with a famous person before. You know, walking around with somebody famous, everybody knew who he was. It was just amazing. So to get around to the book. I was on a book leave from my job at the Washington Post a couple years ago.
And you wrote a book which was called I Forgot to Remember, which was an incredible story. And you've done some investigative reporting on people wrongly convicted. So you're a news guy all the way, Dan.
Yeah, I have credentials to do any kind of journalistic thing. And, I've been all over the map, I guess, the last 20 years. But, yeah, I was finishing up my work on this book about this woman who had suffered Hollywood-style amnesia, lost everything that was in her memory. She was hit on the head by a ceiling fan.
Oh.
Yeah.
Lucky it did cut her head off, for crying out loud.
she suffered traumatic brain injury and also complete retrograde amnesia, and for a while anterograde amnesia, so she couldn't form new memories. And for obvious reasons, she needed a collaborator when she was doing her memoir. You know, memory, I mean, she didn't have much, so I was helping her reconstruct her life, right? But I was finished with that pretty much, so a few years ago, I set out to finally write something about Don, and the sort of narrative journey took me to this wonderful friendship, which is where you led into this. This is that became my, you know, my goal, to write about the friendship.
And what a friendship indeed. Now, the television show itself was dramatic, to be sure. But when Don Knox was in public, what kind of a guy was he? As you said, the people flocked to him. But, you know, there are some, and I have seen them, where they just don't like the public to be around them. Was he different?
Well, yes, and Andy and Don were different from each other in that regard. You know, I don't know what it would be like having people walk up to you all the time and want you to sign something or just acknowledge them or to hear you talk about how important you were in their life. It happened to them thousands and thousands and thousands of times, right? In Don's case, he was very magnanimous. He was the sort who really would never turn anyone away or turn anyone down. I think he had this weird, like, hang up that if he said no to anybody, if he snubbed anybody, that would be the end of his career, that it would be over for him. You know, that it could, that just like that, it could all go up, which is a funny way of looking at your career. So it was almost driven by paranoia or superstition or something, but that's how he was. He had to be surrounded by handlers, you know, people who could say no and say, "I'm sorry, but Mr. Knotts has to go have dinner eventually."
Donald Trump needs that right now.
Well, Andy was more human, more like you or I would probably be. He was often very gracious, but sometimes a little more prickly. I was down in North Carolina doing a book tour, and spoke to people, including radio broadcasters, who had met him, who had heard firsthand accounts. And in Andy's case, it was a little more common to hear that, oh, he just wanted to eat his dinner. He just didn't want to be disturbed. And so there were some people in Manteo, where Andy lived, on the Carolina shore, who said, oh, he was kind of a little bit grouchy, at least toward the end. But, you know, a human person with flaws, complicated guy, you have to admire his body of work. It's amazing, you know.
Andy Griffith died of a heart attack in 2012. Don Knotts died, of course, in 2006 of lung cancer. Was he a heavy smoker?
Oh, gosh. I'm trying to remember now. He had had lung issues. He certainly wasn't a smoker late in life. I mean, it seems like everybody was back in the 50s. But he had had lung issues going back to childhood. He grew up in West Virginia coal country. And, you know, the coal dust, they say, sort of swirled in the wind. And he had a diagnosis of what's it called? It's a disease where the lung tissue hardens, a kind of a
emphysema.
What the heck was it? I'm not going to remember the name of it. But anyway, he had lifelong issues with his lungs. He'd had a case of pneumonia when he was a young adult. So he just had kind of frail, weak lungs all along. And he was very healthy though up to near the end. And it was only in the last months of his life that he was really hobbled. Up to then, he would gallop up the stairs, you know, to his exclusive Beverly Hills gym, and would swim and swim and swim, and he'd eat fish and healthy stuff, you know, fruit plates, and really lived I remember from when he was a man of 60, 65, 70, he was trim. He was healthy. He was athletic. So it all kind of snuck up on him. And I guess that happens to a lot of people, you know.
It sure does. Stick with us. We're going to come back and talk more about your work, Andy and Don, right here on Coast to Coast. And if you remember the program, why don't you check in with us and chime in? We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you with our special guest this hour, Daniel Duvisay, as we talk about his work, Andy and Don. It was 1960 when the Andy Griffith Show started, and of course Don Knotts was Barney Fife. He played that bumbling deputy, and listen to this clip.
Sheriff! Oh, I sure am glad I found you. Boy, have I been doing some detecting.
Have you really?
I sure have. You want to hear about it?
Wait. Floyd, being in public office and all, I don't dare get too adorable.
Andy, listen.
Wait, if you got a little talcum powder, I could use a little of that. What is it, Floyd?
You know that still we've been suspecting one up at Hawks Point?
Yeah.
Well, I just come that close to knocking it over.
No.
Yeah?
You come that close?
Yeah.
Well, what happened?
Well, I couldn't find it.
You remember those little clips, Daniel?
Oh gosh, yeah. It's wonderful hearing them together. And one of the points of my book is to celebrate the two of them as a comedy duo. You don't usually think of them that way because they were surrounded by this whole ensemble of lovable goofballs. And there were so many great performers on that show. I mean, everybody from Jim Nabors to Jack Dodson, George Lindsay, Hal Smith. But I think that at the heart of the show was this amazing friendship between the sheriff and the deputy, just kind of watching the world go by around them. And they did some wonderful skit comedy work that I think should be likened to the work of Abbott and Costello, Laurel and Hardy, Martin and Lewis, the septic tank sketch, the lawman's code sketch, which is later revived as the preamble of the Constitution sketch where Barney thinks he's memorized the thing, but he can't remember a single syllable of it. It's just great, and you get just as much richness out of it if you're just listening to it. You don't even have to watch it.
In the television show, Daniel, they seemed like simpletons, but in real life, what were they like?
Oh, boy, anything but. I think that both of these guys had... I hate to reduce stuff, but really three essential qualities. Number one, they were both of them very, very intelligent men. They fought their way up from down in the South and came up to New York and conquered it and came to Hollywood and conquered it. And each of them had a plan, a really meticulous, ironed out plan for how to become successful. So intelligent, also very, very ambitious. Neither Andy nor Don would ever give up. You have to remember that, gosh, the first big credit that they had together, the place where they met, was on Broadway in the mid-50s, and it was this play called No Time for Sergeants, which we still kind of remember now, even though it's been, 60 years. It was a huge deal in its day. It was a big hit book, and it became a big hit Broadway show, and it became a big hit movie. And both of these guys talked their way onto the cast of that production. They weren't going to make it. I think Andy wasn't a big enough name really to be the lead role in that play, and he basically just hustled his way onto it by breaking into a routine right there in the casting room, and people sort of gathered around to hear this routine, almost like a scene out of a movie, and they hired him. They said, boy, he's our guy. And Don, again, this gets at their ambition. He was late. He showed up at the very end of the casting, the day they were calling people for to get roles, and he was late, and he had to beg, and he had to plead, and he used his puppy dog Barney eyes, and he got a part. So then the third trait was just that both of them were so talented, and in similar ways and in different ways, they could both be very, very funny. They were both tremendous actors. Do you know that Billy Bob Thornton told me when I interviewed him that he felt that Don is actually his favorite comedic actor ever, maybe even his favorite actor, full stop, for the work he did on films like The Ghost and Mr. Chicken and The Reluctant Astronaut. Andy, let's not forget, played one of the most amazing, just spellbinding dramatic roles ever in the film A Face in the Crowd, which Kazan made in the second half of the 50s. And you forget that, but he was this amazing, just scenery-shredding maniac in that film, and so had amazing range, maybe even more range, pure range than Don had. So those three qualities, that's the reason why we're talking about these guys today.
Any surprises with these individuals?
Oh, well, yeah, remember, there's not really been a I guess, a journalistic book about these guys or that show. There's wonderful books about Mayberry out there, but they're mostly kind of fan books, kind of celebrating the show and the characters. There's not a whole lot of exploration previously into the guys themselves, the actual human beings behind these roles. So I'm a journalist, right? I'm not just related to Don. I'm also a reporter. And I went out and dug and got, gosh, I interviewed every living soul I could find who, you know, would be interviewed to talk about either one of them. I got a mountain of clippings from the Library of Congress and the University Library at the University of Maryland, and the Internet, which is an amazing resource these days, and read books and just amassed lots of stories. So, I mean, where do you begin? Don was a fairly neurotic person in real life, and maybe people didn't realize how extensive this was. This was a guy for whom, like, hand sanitizer was invented. He really was
Mr. Limpet, wasn't he?
He was. There was a lot of the nervous man in him. If you were in the room with him and you sneezed or something, he would sort of back away.
Germophobic. He was like Howard Hughes.
Getting sick, yeah. He would shut himself in his room, sometimes for days on end before a live television performance. I would imagine even being on, like, on the radio live, such as we are here, would terrify him. He really was always afraid that if he blew it just once, if he went up once in his lines, if he forgot what he was doing just once, that would be curtains for him. He was a hypochondriac as well. Andy had a pretty ferocious temper. He used to talk about his foibles as a human. Back in the 50s and 60s, when he gave interviews, he was very forthcoming and wide open about himself. But so many years have passed, and people forgot this, you know, over time. He would put his hand through doors and windows and car windshields in anger. He could be a pretty fearsome guy. On the set of The Griffith Show, he was admirably restrained and apparently never really lost his cool.
Really?
Never had sort of an explosion, right? But he could show his disapproval through his silence. And George Lindsay, who played Goober, wrote a memoir some time back in which he recounts Andy sort of freezing him over whenever he wasn't happy with the work he'd done. And apparently that could be very painful if you were on the cast and Andy didn't sort of call to say what a good job you'd done that week.
That's amazing. Now, Don won 5 Emmys for his role in the Andy Griffith Show, didn't he?
5. I think it was a record at the time for a person playing the same part. If you talk to current comedic actors today, people who've been on the big shows like Seinfeld or Big Bang Theory, they all know Don. They all know his record, and they're smitten with his work. He's a legend within comedy. Andy didn't win any Emmys, didn't even get nominated for an Emmy.
That's right.
And he was hurt and I think resentful of that. I say in my book that during the years they were on the show together, Andy never talked with Don about the awards he'd won. He never gave him an attaboy. It was like too painful for him to even broach that topic. Don, for his part, I would say was equally sort of resentful of Andy's financial success as, I think, half owner of the Griffith Show. Andy, it made him rich. It made him a rich man. Now, Don, for his part, was paid a straight salary. And at the peak, you know, his final couple of years on the show, he earned $100,000 a year, which was a lot of money in 1965 in Hollywood. But compare that with owning half of the show.
Yeah,
or
it wasn't superstar money by any means.
No, not at all. Yeah, so that was kind of the chip on his shoulder. They were wonderful, wonderful friends. I mean, they adored each other, but there was always this kind of resentment in the background, and I write about it extensively in the book.
Andy kept busy after the show ended, but he really didn't hit stardom again until Matlock in 1986, right?
There's this whole 15-year drought for Andy, and I shouldn't call it a drought because there's a lot of great movies he made in those.
Yeah,
movies.
I mean, he worked in that span, but he didn't hit a home run.
He worked and he worked and he worked really hard and made a bunch of movies. A lot of them were made for television movies. Those were a big deal in the 70s, you know, lest we forget. Go Ask Alice was one of them. And Pray for the Wildcats, which is, that's a turkey. That could be like Mystery Science Theater territory right there. But Andy was good in almost all of these roles. What he was doing, he was reinventing himself as a serious sort of heavy actor. He wanted to gravitate away from the sheriff. He wanted to break free of that typecast. You know, he didn't want everybody to think of him as the sheriff of Mayberry. And it took him 15 years before the network executives recognized his abilities, and the reward he got for that was Matlock, which is a heavier character. It's not quite so goofy. Well, not that the sheriff was goofy, but the sheriff was a light role.
And that lasted 9 years.
Sorry?
That show lasted 9 years.
Yeah. It was on the air longer than the Griffith Show, actually. It's amazing.
Beat it by a year. That's right. Let's take some calls here for you, Dan.
Sure.
Let's go to Stacy in Massachusetts to get things started. Hello, Stacy. Welcome to the program.
Hello. Well, when I caught Andy Griffith, I was, you know, in the rerun stage because it was before my time. I thought he was funny, but I liked him more in Three's Company because I was a little older, and it was hard to take him seriously in Andy Griffith after he was so funny in Three's Company, and I can't see, so I try to picture his facial expressions when he talked.
What's the name of the landlord that he played in the Three's Company?
Mr. Furley.
That's right, Ralph Furley, indeed. Perfect, you got that. He was funny in that part too, Dan.
Yeah, one of the funniest things about that Ralph Furley part was his wardrobe. Every week he would come out wearing a different sort of Technicolor getup, and the costume people delighted in putting these ensembles together. And I interviewed Joyce DeWitt, who played Janet, and I interviewed Richard Klein, who played Larry, the wingman for Jack Tripper. And they said it would take all of the it would take everything in their body to not just explode in laughter when Ralph Furley would walk onto the set wearing these ridiculous get-ups. I remember that from when I was in middle school. I used to watch that show all the time.
And the show was, I think, in black and white. Did it ever go to color? I don't think so. Well, there was no color in 68, which is when it ended.
You know, this is an important point because the passionate fans of the Griffith Show will always tell you that it didn't go color until I think after Don was gone, and the last couple seasons were in color, the last three seasons. And if the episode is in color, then you know Don's pretty much not on it. And that's the point of demarcation there, because a lot of the even really passionate fans don't watch the color episodes.
I can't remember how they wrote Don out of the script. What happened?
Oh, he wasn't really written out of the script. This is how TV was back in the 60s. They didn't take these continuity matters very seriously. So it was like he was there one week and gone the next. I explain in the book, they didn't really make much account for his departure. I think Aunt Bee makes some reference to, well, it's a sad Barney's gone, but
you know, fire.
There's not a big farewell. He isn't really sent off in a formal way, and it's kind of odd watching it now.
Richard in Washington, welcome to the program. Richard, go ahead.
Hi, George and Daniel. Thanks so much for this show. Don Knotts is my favorite actor of all time.
Oh, great.
I must have seen The Ghost and Mr. Chicken about 2,000 times. So my question is related to that. Did Don ever express to you what his favorite work was of all time that he participated in? Thank you so much.
Well, sure thing.
Well, that's a great question. I think that he realized, just as Andy did, that their greatest work really was probably The Griffith Show, singly and collectively. I think they had to give the nod to that performance. They cherished it. They were so proud of it. They were so proud that it had happened together, and they realized they were better together than apart. And I think that's a point I would defend to the death. But when I talked to Don, we always talked about the beginning of his career, the days when he was in New York trying to make it, and he woke up one morning with this character in his head, and it was the Nervous Man character, and it was a combination of some existing models of other characters. There was a guy named Benchley who was sort of a nervous kind of convention speaker character, and everybody's forgotten this guy, but he was in Don's head. But Don created out of that a new character who became the core of all of the characters he played, I believe. And it came to him literally like in a dream, like the way Keith Richards woke up with the Satisfaction
right.
lick in his head.
And Don had that look to be able to play that part of a very nervous Nelly type guy.
He was born with a great expressive face that was perfectly suited to that role. And what I was going to say is I think he was most proud of that creation of anything he did, because he talked about it with such fondness. He was so proud to have just woken up with this great character in his brain, and that character is infused with every single show he did, every movie. There's at least a kernel of the nervous guy in there.
Let's go to Gary in New York City. Hello, Gary. Thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. 2 points, if I may. I've probably watched the Andy Griffith Show from the beginning to now. In New York City, it's on twice in the nighttime.
Wow.
And the other point being with that movie, The Ghost and Mr. Chicken, which was on last night, if you watch closely or get a tape of that from the very beginning, Hope Summers and Hal Smith are in there. That's in the beginning. Then you go to Burt Mustin. I believe there's 7 to 9 regular, semi-regulars from the show that are in that Ghost of Mr. Chicken.
Leaked them all in and got them in there. That's cool. What really ticked Don Knotts off? When Don Knotts was upset, what was it that was the catalyst, Daniel?
I just want to give kudos to that listener. Andy and Don collaborated on that film. It was right after Don left the show, and it was a real reunion of some of the great, great minds of the Griffith Show. So that movie's kind of like a farewell to that ensemble in a way, and it's cool he pointed that out. Don, I've got a good story about Don.
And I've got a minute left. Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, after he left the Griffith Show, he did a play in Hollywood, The Mind with a Dirty Man, and it was always nerve-wracking for a Hollywood talent to do a play in Hollywood, because all your friends would see if he succeeded or failed. He got mostly good reviews, but one of the critics panned him. I think it was maybe the LA Times or the Herald Examiner. Don hated that, and he hated getting panned. He called the critic the next day and said, I'm sorry, but I didn't read the review. Would you mind reading it to me over the phone? And so he makes the reporter spit out this horrible review over the phone, Don did. And the guy sputtered and spat it out, and when he was done, there was a silence. And then Don just yelled, thanks, and slammed down the phone.
That's great. That is great. Well, if people want to get this book, where do they find it, Andy and Don?
Oh, you just Google Andy Don book. You'll find it. It's on Amazon. It's at all your favorite independent bookstores. My website is danieldevizet.com, but you don't need me to get the book. It's all over the place.
Beautiful. And your first book, I forgot to remember, that's still available?
Yeah, and there, yes, it is. It's a wonderful story about a woman who lost her entire memory. It's like stranger than fiction.
I love it. Daniel, thank you, and continue to make yourself available on the program, because you are a great resource. That was fun. It was a great program. I remember it from 10. I was 10 years old to 18, and we used to watch it almost every week when it was on. Well, it brings back great memories. Next up, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe joins us. Don't touch your dial.